and welcome to Eye on the Middle East, a weekly podcast produced by NeonTommy.com at USC Annenberg Digital News. I'm your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. Today, we will be discussing the ongoing protests in Egypt, Israel's reaction to the massive demonstrations, and potential spillovers into Egypt's neighboring countries. We are joined today by Dr. Roxana Bahrami-Tosh, an expert on the Middle East, gender, and globalization.
The Eye on the Middle East cast can now be found on iTunes. Just search Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East. Well, Arzu, I don't think either of us could have thought that the unrest we witnessed in Tunisia just a couple weeks ago would have spread so quickly across the Middle East. Hundreds of thousands of demonstrators gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square Tuesday, demanding that President Hosni Mubarak step down. The demand did not fall onto deaf ears, as Mubarak announced late Tuesday that he would not seek re-election. So what stands in the way for a more immediate departure for Mubarak?
I think the posture of the military continues to be the biggest determinant. The military, in most cases of social unrest, plays a calibrated role. And one of the major reasons why the protests in Iran, for example, fell apart is because there wasn't a significant defection of the security forces. And that same security apparatus in Iran wasn't reluctant to use violent means to suppress the demonstrations in 2009. In Egypt's case, even though the ground troops seemed to be engaging in solidarity behavior with the Egyptian people, the high officers seem to still support Mubarak. So I think the posture of the military will ultimately determine which side is going to come out triumphant. Now, let me also add that this morning on Al Jazeera, there were reports that pro-Mubarak protesters had entered the demonstrations in Tahrir Square. So while the military's position is to be closely followed, we should also be aware that there are Mubarak supporters out there, and their role and their voice shouldn't be underestimated either.
So do you think Mubarak will make it to the September elections?
You know, I doubt it. I do think that Mubarak's days are numbered, mostly because of the state of the economy. And economic pressure is one of the most decisive in getting regimes to understand that it simply can't endure. Even though foreign direct investment into Egypt has increased considerably in the past few years, thanks in part to recent economic liberalization measures, one of the main obstacles still facing the Egyptian economy is the uneven distribution of wealth. 2 out of 5 people are living in poverty. So no, looking at the situation through an economic lens, I don't think the Egyptians can simply let him stay in power until September.
And you know, Arzu, it's interesting you bring up the economic aspect of this because as we know, Egypt is one of the largest recipients of U.S. foreign aid. And bringing up the United States, obviously there's a role that the United States has in this situation. What do you think this means for the U.S. and U.S. foreign policy?
Well, you know, I don't think that we have the right to think about U.S. interests in that region before really thinking about Egypt's interest. And I've heard a lot of analysis that attempts to explain what this all means for the United States. And that kind of dialogue seems to be, in some ways, the reason why the Egyptians are protesting. Hmm. What is good for the U.S. isn't always good for the citizenry of a particular country. I think that ultimately the protests in Egypt and the demonstrations in Tunisia are indirect consequences of failed U.S. policy in that region. And the fact that one of our first questions with regard to the protests in Egypt is, you know, what does this mean for the U.S. shows that we still don't get it. American interests cannot continue to reign supreme in all corners of the world. So until we figure out what this means for Egypt and what it means for their people and their future, I don't know that we can or should think about the implications for the U.S. So Egypt's neighbors are closely following the unrest in the region. The street revolt in Egypt has thrown the Israeli government and military into turmoil, forcing top officials to rethink their most significant regional relationship. Now, Ben, what has Israel's relationship been like with Egypt and President Mubarak?
Well, I'd say historically, Egypt's relationship with President Mubarak has been a friendly one. Israel has a cold peace with Egypt up until now, and Israel has watched fearfully since the protests started in Egypt that they could possibly lose one of their friends in the region. If Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, which is the main opposition group in Egypt, gains power during this turmoil, the balance of power between rival Palestinian camps could change. And that's obviously a concern for the Israelis. Back to the friendship between Mubarak and Netanyahu in particular, there is there is a certain sentiment that the two are mutually afraid over Iran's strengthening and rising to power within the region, especially with regard to their Islamist movement, as well as the weakening and distancing of the U.S. government with Barack Obama at head. So I would say that it's been a good relationship, and the Israelis are very fearful. You can see that is evident as when they took out their diplomats and families of the diplomats last week during the protests.
And what can you say about what this means for Israel's security? What are they so worried about?
Look, the Israelis are nervous, and to be perfectly honest, they should be nervous. The ugly facts are that the two peace treaties that Israel has conducted so far, the one between Egypt and the other one with Jordan, were both signed with dictators, Anwar Sadat and King Hussein. These are the two countries that also met with President Obama and Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the PA, to help broker a peace deal with the Israelis. And now, from the Israeli perspective, there is serious instability in Egypt and doubt from these countries in their leadership. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has asked U.S. President Barack Obama and another of other Western leaders in recent days to make it clear to any new Egyptian regime that, in fact, they must regard the Israeli peace deal with Egypt as still valid. I don't really think that Israel really cares who runs Egypt as long as the peace deal stays intact. Moving to our third topic, as Israel grapples with the repercussions of Egyptian protests, a number of analysts are wondering, who is next? The Middle East is populated by a number of monarchies and emirates, all of which have some sort of familial tie associated with the delineation of leadership. From Qatar and Oman to Jordan and Yemen, which government do you think is most immediately at risk?
Well, in an attempt to defuse any budding tension, King Abdullah of Jordan dumped his government after thousands of Jordanians took to the streets early this week. It remains to be seen if Abdullah's move is enough, especially when many Jordanians hold successive governments responsible for drawn-out recession and growing public debt that this year hit a record $15 billion. Now, if you're wondering about Syria, I would argue that their improving economy reduces the likelihood for much spillover into that country. In Syria, 1 in 10 lives in poverty, which is still high, but this figure is far below Egypt's rate of 40%. Official figures in Syria also show unemployment fell from over 12% in 2005 to 8.1% in 2009, whereas some analysts say the unemployment is closer to 25% in Egypt. But what about Yemen, Ben? Where do they stand?
I was just going to say, I think that Yemen is probably most immediately at risk. Just earlier today, Yemeni President Saleh said that he would not seek a new term, not seek re-election. And it's true, you know, he said this before. In 2005, he said he wasn't going to seek re-election, and lo and behold, he's still in office. But I think that Yemen is most immediately at risk, and here's why. In Yemen, there is a very high level of unemployed, as in many Middle Eastern countries. However, there's a very concerted attempt by the youth and by the university students to oust Saleh. To combat this, Saleh has promised concessions for university students and graduates, which includes a plan to expand Yemen's social security network and to provide monetary assistance to some 500,000 needy families. So, yeah, I would argue that it would be Yemen. Yemen's the next to go, and I wouldn't be surprised if we saw this being the last term for Saleh. We want to take a quick break to remind you that you are listening to Eye on the Middle East. Eye on the Middle East can now be found on iTunes. Just search Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East. I am your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. Dr. Roxana Bahramitash joins us in the next segment for a fascinating discussion on women in the Middle East and the female voice in the ongoing Egyptian protests.
Stay tuned.
Dr. Roxana Bahramitash has worked with several international development agencies, including the Canadian Development Agency, the International Development Research Center, and the United Nations Development Program. She is the author of Veiled Employment, Islamism, and the Political Economy of Women's Employment in Iran, and Gender in Contemporary Iran, Pushing the Boundaries. She earned her PhD in sociology from McGill University and is now working on a World Bank-funded project on female entrepreneurship. Dr. Bahramitash, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
So let me start out by first asking, can you talk a little bit about the female voice in these demonstrations that have been unfolding in Tunisia and now in Egypt?
Of course, a lot of it brings back the memories of the Iranian Revolution, in which I participated. I was one of those young people who was on the streets in 1979. And I have seen less women, much less women, in both Cairo and Tunisia than it was the case in Iran. I know that although that they are not as present as, currently the Cairo and Tahrir Square, they're all filled with men only, but a glimpse of a nearby mosque which had been turned into a hospital, you see more women. You see that women are there. And, of course, during the peaceful days of demonstrations, women were very much part of the demonstrators. And that's not a surprise. The level of education has increased throughout the region, Middle East, North Africa. There is now employment figures have increased. The right to vote. I mean, women in Middle East have been participated in public life increasingly, even though they're because of sexual segregation or because of veil, the image or the stereotypical assumptions that in the West, even though they are not seen, their presence is very much significant. For example, currently, the number of female entrepreneurs in Saudi Arabia is extremely high. I mean, you just wouldn't, in a country where women don't drive cars, there are a large number of them own businesses.
Now, Professor, what does the potential return of Islamist parties in the region mean for women in countries like Egypt or Tunisia?
Well, I think that's a $1 million question. I mean, the Islamist movement is not a monolithic movement. Take the case of, Tunisia is very much different from Egypt.
Right.
Let's talk about Egypt for a moment. You have Ikhwan al-Muslimin, Muslim Brotherhood, and you have the Jamaat, for example. These are just two of the Islamist party. Now, just not let's focus on Ikhwan. The Ikhwan is also not monolithic. Ikhwan has a huge faction. They have a conference every March, and you see a continuum of opinions that divide Muslim Brotherhood. So we first have to understand that we're not talking about monolithic Islamist groups. Even when we talk about one single Islamic party in one country, and then their views on women, of course, differs according because of their variations. For example, on a more general level, the sort of more liberal faction of Muslim Brotherhood, they have a yearly conference, and they are very much close to the left, and their spokesperson for Hezbollah, for example, who attended the conference, was a woman. So they are having women representatives. And then on the other side of the continuum, you have those who are more conservative, and then the Jamaat, whereas the Jamaat is really very, very conservative and traditionalist.
Now, forgive me for interrupting. I just wanted to ask you something about unemployment. I know unemployment in Egypt is very high. What is unemployment like for women?
Well, the employment pattern for Egypt is you have women, a number of educated women of the elite who fill up middle-class jobs, and then you have the fellahin or the peasant women. So the middle class is less likely to be employed. Throughout the region, the general employment is low. That we know. But that's in the formal economy. When we look at the informal sector, of course, a lot of women, particularly in the peasant and the fallahin, they are employed but not recorded. But when there is unemployment, then, you know, there is no jobs. There is no jobs for men and women. But, of course, the case of Tunisia, of course, it was different because women were encouraged to take up jobs in bureaucracy and the education, the public sector. But and also Tunisia did have some kind of the state policy was to encourage women's employment. But in the case of Egypt, this wasn't the case.
Let's hit back on that point. What factors determine the changing roles of women in the Middle East and other Islamic countries?
I think that most people, the stereotype tends to concentrate and focus on Islam as a factor, and I think that to some extent is as culture is important. Culture is important, but culture doesn't explain everything. There is a tendency to focus on culture and Islam at the expense of looking at other factors, social factors, factors such as population, factors such as increasing education, factors as political economy. For example, in the Gulf countries, you know, there is oil, and because of oil, they have embarked on capital-intensive industrialization, which doesn't need labor, and they have been importing labor and male labor. I mean, that's dramatically different from Southeast Asia, where there's no oil and there's cheap labor and women. What I find often misleading is this overemphasis on the rise of support for Islamist groups, and I see that itself as a result of one of my arguments is that if modernization agenda had actually worked in Middle East, North Africa, there would not be support for Islamist groups. In the case of Iran, if the 1953 coup was not waged on the country would have probably been a secular country. There would not have been an Islamic revolution. In the case of Egypt, the rise of the Middle East support for Islamic group is related to the failure of state to deliver social goods.
Dr. Bahram Etash, thank you for joining us today. This is Eye on the Middle East, broadcast live from the basement of the USC Annenberg Graduate School of Journalism.
And please, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just search for Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East. Thank you, and stay tuned for next week's cast. Take care.